Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hey, everybody. Wow, today we have a great one for a change. And this time, I mean it. Mayor Melvin Carter, mayor of St. Paul, first black mayor of St. Paul, is with me for a great, great conversation. And this time, I mean it. Now, let me say something about that. The this time I mean it thing. I got an email from a listener, and I won't say her name. Let's call her Enid Goubeau. Anyway, she wrote, "Al, I'm a big fan, love the podcast, but I had to write you because I listened to your interview and I don't want to embarrass this guest. So let's just call him Steve Schmidt." And I listened all the way through, and I have to say, it never got to be what I would call great. Okay, first of all, I thought it was great, but look, Enid, a podcast is show business. And when I say, this is a great one this time, I mean it, I don't always mean it, okay? But this one, with Melvin Carter, I do. You will really love Melvin. Fabulous guy. And it all comes from his parents. Melvin 2, Melvin the mayor is Melvin 3, and Tony. Now, Tony is a county commissioner. She's chair now of the whole county commission. And Melvin 2 was a cop. And we discussed that, being the first black mayor of St. Paul and his dad having been a St. Paul cop. And his dad was a great cop, a community policeman who started a nonprofit called Save Our Sons, which Melvin talks about. And we have a pretty wide-ranging discussion, including talking about the historical disparities in St. Paul. Melvin grew up in the Rondo neighborhood of St. Paul, beautiful, historically black neighborhood. And Roy Wilkins, who was a great civil rights leader during the 60s, grew up in the Rondo neighborhood of St. Paul. And here's what he wrote about it. And this is him growing up in the late 1920s. "It is a riot of warm colors, feeling, and sounds. Music is in abundance from Victrolas, saxophones, player pianos, and hurry-up orchestras. It seethes with the pulsating beauty of the lives of its people." Okay, that's Rondo, a great neighborhood. Now, a few decades ago, they put a freeway through Rondo without telling anybody, basically, and they confiscated property of homeowners, including Melvin's grandmother. And they gave folks pennies on the dollar. And then Melvin tells about the fire department burning down his grandmother's house as an exercise for the trainees in the fire department. Now, before we go to Melvin, I want to go to Chris Montana, who is a business owner in Minneapolis. He is the first black owner of a micro distillery in the United States. Now, Chris Rock, my friend, says he does not like to give a lot of credit to any first black entrepreneur who started a business that has nothing to do with being black. That's what Chris says. Chris Montana is the owner of this distillery, and it got severe damage during the civil disturbances after the murder of George Floyd. He's going to be fine. He has insurance, but he has started a GoFundMe to help other black and brown-owned businesses in Minneapolis and in the Twin Cities. And I'm doing something to help that with Sarah Silverman. We love Sarah Silverman here on the Al Franken podcast. And we're going to be doing a virtual cocktail party that you can be a participant in if you win the raffle. We have a raffle. So you can go to alfranken.com to find out all the information, and you can enter this raffle with a chance to have a virtual cocktail party with me, Sarah Silverman, and Chris Montana. And you don't even have to donate to get into the raffle, but don't be a schmuck, okay? So if you enter, you got to give, or I will see you in hell. So I'm going to talk to Chris Montana now, and after that, with Melvin Carter, the mayor of St. Paul. With me, as promised, Chris Montana, the first black owner of a spirits distillery. Is that right?
Micro distillery, yeah.
And it's Dunord Craft Spirits in Correct. Minneapolis. And the place sustained damage from being set on fire. Is that correct? During the demonstrations?
Yeah, our warehouse had about 5 fires set inside of it.
Listen, people get a word picture of somebody when they're on here, and we can't. This isn't video, so I just want to make sure on the name. We've discussed this, Chris Montana. It's complicated how you got Montana. Your birth mother got divorced, and when she got divorced, she didn't want her maiden name. She didn't want her married name, so she just liked Montana. So you are Chris Montana. I'll tell you why I just say this. I just do not want my audience to get the idea that they may be giving money to a black guy who's wearing like a fringe jacket, cowboy boots, and a Stetson.
Riding a motorcycle? Right.
Or worse, a horse or something. And, you know, you get a kind of word picture of who I'm talking to. And I just want to make sure that the Montana part, that's not you. That part, that picture.
It usually throws people.
Okay, let's go to the actual important stuff. Okay, you are in the Lake Street neighborhood?
Yes.
And that's where Dunord Crafts is. And you had insurance. You have good insurance, right?
How good it is remains to be seen. I mean, but we do have insurance, and it's going to help us deal with the losses.
So you're putting together a GoFundMe that Sarah Silverman and I will be helping, and that I hope my listeners will be helping. And if they want to, they can go to alfranken.com. And I just want them to know that none of this will be going to you or your micro distillery.
Yeah, the purpose of the GoFundMe is to help the other businesses who might be in a little bit of a worse situation than we are. As you mentioned, we have insurance. We'll see what it pays out, but it's going to pay out something. A lot of people have none, or they're massively underinsured. And we want to get some money into people's pockets quickly, so that we don't lose some of these businesses that added to the diversity of businesses along the Lake Street corridor and other places in the Twin Cities.
I'll get back to the GoFundMe in a bit, but I just want folks to know how dedicated you are to your community. Immediately after the demonstration and the fires, you also started a food pantry, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, you can call it what you want. I've alternatively called it a food bank, food shelf. One way or the other, we're trying to get the needed essentials into community hands. We had a Target, we had a Cub Foods, we had another grocery store. All of them have been looted and partially burned. There's no place to buy anything. All the restaurants are gone.
So post the demonstrations, the area became a food desert.
Yes, extremely so. There's not even the option if you had a little bit of money. So we've had kids walking around in, you know, rotten diapers. I mean, it really did get bad, and there's been no coordinated response to help. And so we jumped in and started taking donations, and predictably those donations were great for a couple of weeks. And as people start to move on, they get less so, but we've been doing about 400 families a day coming through our facility to get food for that night.
Let's talk about that, people moving on, because as we speak, it's you say that there's kind of a cliff on donations, is that right?
It's what worries me. If, you know, George Floyd's murder, I think, woke a lot of people up if they weren't already paying attention. I hope they don't go back to sleep. And what we normally do is something like this happens and we all, you know, put the appropriate social media posts up, but then you move on and you move on to the next thing. And for some communities, certainly for my community, that's not possible. And we're going to be dealing with the fallout from this for years. I mean, the Lake Street was a vibrant area. It's a wasteland now. It's going to take a lot of time to bring it back. And the repercussions are going to be with us, not just in the property damage, but also in the need to make some changes. So I hope that people don't just turn the page.
Okay, let's talk about the GoFundMe. This is going to go to Black and Brown owned businesses in the Lake Street corridor. Is that right?
Yeah, Lake Street corridor and Greater Minneapolis, St. Paul. If you were affected by the riots, then we're going to try to help out. The fund is looking forward. It's about making sure that those businesses stick around. And that's just the business side of it. There's a bigger onion here, but we can't do everything. But, you know, a year from now, we're functionally going to be in the same place, right? And I don't think we're going to have massive police reforms nationally. We don't really have the leadership at the top to make things like that happen. So I just hope that the conversation keeps going and people don't just switch off.
I think we're beginning to have this conversation, and any new conversations are always hard, but I really hope, these conversations continue.
You and me both. I think we have to recognize it's hard to do. Yeah, it's tough. You know, I'm a guy, I've never been a woman. It's hard for me to talk to a woman about what it's like to be a woman and what freaks her out and what are the unique challenges that she has. And yeah, I have to talk to someone who I trust, who's not going to then go post on Facebook, hey, this guy asked me this question, you know, what a jerk, or, you know, why wouldn't he already know the answer? Isn't this so obvious? I mean, there has to be trust there. Trust is in short supply these days.
Yep.
But we got to start somewhere. And, you know, it's like I said, it's hard, but that's no excuse. You still got to do it.
Well, you and I and Sarah Silverman are going to be having a conversation with the lucky winner of our raffle. It's going to be a virtual cocktail party. And we're going to be using some of your distilled products, some of your spirits. You'll supply the recipe. And what do you do? Vodka, gin, and whiskey?
Vodka, gin, whiskey. We have an apple liqueur and a coffee liqueur.
The one time I tried to drink, which probably is why I didn't drink until much later, I was like 10 years old, and my parents went out, you know, to dinner or something. And I went in my parents' room, and my dad had bay rum, which is a cologne, but I thought it was rum. So I took a hit of the bay rum, and I was off rum for quite a while.
I imagine you were.
Got to take a break right now. We'll be right back with St. Paul Mayor Melvin Carter.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Mr. Mayor, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's talk about you. You're in not a unique position, but a kind of rare position, which you're the first black mayor of St. Paul. I guess that's unique. And both Twin Cities have had recent histories of police killing innocent African-American men. Your dad was a cop, Melvin II. You're the third, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. And so you're the son of a cop. You're a black man. That puts you sort of in, I think, in a good position, interesting position. How does that guide you?
It's a good question. I mean, at some point, it just is who I am. And mm-hmm. So, you know, at some point, I don't know how to separate, you know, that part of who I am versus every other part of who I am. I grew up, you know, praying for the safety of our officers. I grew up, you know, sending dad to work. He would work midnights and, you know, we'd have to tiptoe around the house during the day because he'd be trying to get his sleep between shifts. And, you know, we'd come home from school and turn on the TV and see some horrific news report of something going on in the city and the manhunt is going, and you know, we'd be, you know that dad was on the search, and you know, be hoping for his safety and praying for his safety. So, you know, I remember those things very well. I remember, you know, he went on the department with a class of African-American officers who went on together after a court order required us to desegregate our police department.
Was that in the 70s?
In the early 70s.
Yeah.
And so we grew up around officers. My friends' fathers were officers, and, you know, we had, you know, they knew us, and they would take us to football practice and, you know, take us around, and they knew the neighborhood, they knew our friends, and they knew community really well. So we really looked up to them and saw them just serving community in a really unique way that nobody else could. They'd solve problems, Al, that, like, if you weren't an officer, you probably couldn't solve. And if you weren't from the community, you probably wouldn't even know it was a problem in the first place. And, you know, so we would see them. But then I turned 16 and started getting pulled over, started meeting some. I used to tell my father, I met a whole lot more of his coworkers then. And, you know, we don't have time for me to tell you all of the just ridiculous stories of the times that I've been pulled over for things that just clearly had no, you know, or searched for things that just had clearly nothing to do with the way that I was driving. And so, you know, to me, you know, it all really kind of goes together, because as I think about my father, when he showed up, my hope was that people wouldn't judge him based on what some other officer did, that if they thought he did something wrong, that he would have access to kind of fair process and be able to kind of tell his side of the story. And to tell you the truth, that's my hope for Philando Castile and for George Floyd and all the rest of us as well. And so I think the main thing that I've tried to bring to the conversation is that this is a conversation not about police versus community, but it's a conversation about all of our humanity and our ability to recognize humanity. And, you know, for all of the concerns that we have about officers and making sure that we're not having witch hunts on officers and things like that, if your right to culture or your job means, you know, an ability to, you know, choke George Floyd for 9 minutes, 8 minutes and 46 seconds, or, you know, shoot Philando Castile while he's in the car with his 4-year-old, then we have to reassess the whole thing.
And that is what we're doing.
We're talking about it at least, but we need policy.
We do. And I think you're in a good position to do that by virtue of your background and also who you are. We've known each other for what, like 13 years or something like that?
At least quite a while. It might be a little bit longer than that. 16, I think. I'm going 16.
Okay. All right. All right. And I remember going door knocking with you.
That's right. You went door knocking with me on election day in 2007 when I was first running for city council. And I ran. We ran between doors.
That's, well, you're a runner. First of all, they should know this. You're a sprinter.
I was. I'm in my 40s now, so I can't say that in any present tense.
No, but I mean, you're fast. Is that fair to say?
Yes. That's fair to say.
Okay. And what, did you get the full boat, a scholarship at Florida A&M?
Yep, that's right.
Okay, you're fast and smart, but mainly fast.
But mainly fast.
Okay, Mr. Mayor, can I, you know, you should call me Al. I think you did. So I can call you Melvin, can I?
Absolutely.
Okay. And I know your folks pretty well.
That's
and your
right.
dad is just a stellar guy. And so is your mom. Melvin's mom has been a county commissioner for as long as I can remember. And she's now the head of the board, right, or something?
Yeah, she's the board chair.
Yeah.
And look, they're who I get this from. So, you know, my father, you know, when I was in high school, he was the juvenile detective for the area that included my high school, Central High School, which you know very well. His area covered my home, my church, my high school, the rec centers I grew up playing in. And I'd go to school and people would say, you know, hey, I met your dad yesterday. And I go, oh, really? During the workday, huh? You know, I didn't know that that's what that meant. But then they'd say, yeah, he was really cool. So my father founded a nonprofit organization called Save Our Sons. You've been to fundraisers for Save Our Sons. And, you know, it ultimately came from this notion that I've heard him tell this story that says, like, you'd have mothers who would come and he'd be the juvenile detective. And they'd come and say, hey, you got to help me, like, save my son. You got to help me do something. And as a police officer, the line for him was, well, call me if he does something illegal and I'll come arrest him. And that's not really what those mothers were looking for, right? That they were looking for some ability to invest in these young men before they were getting arrested or doing something that was jeopardizing their life or health or safety. And so that's why he started to Save Our Sons, to mentor and to engage and intervene with these young men and try to point them in a different space. And we have Save Our Sons boys who have grown up to become lawyers. One's a tax lawyer, professionals, nurses, just
oh, all he's types a tax lawyer?
Yeah, exactly.
Great.
Exactly.
Thank you for your service.
That's right. I'll tell him you said so. But then, like with mom's work at the county in Ramsey County, mom spearheaded an initiative called Juvenile Detention Alternatives Initiative. It started, I think, 2005. And it started with this just simple notion that we have too many young people in detention. And I'll tell you, Al, we started off with our detention center packed beyond capacity, literally cots in the halls. And since 2005, they have reduced their average daily admissions to our juvenile detention centers by somewhere right around 80%. And they have we've closed Boys Totem Town, a residential kind of secure facility for youth. We've closed whole wings of the juvenile detention centers, and we haven't seen a correlating increase in juvenile crime. And the great thing about that is, the terrible thing about our whole juvenile justice system in the first place is research shows that controlling for other factors, a young person who spends a night in juvenile detention is more likely to be an adult offender. We're actually, our juvenile justice system increases the likelihood of our young people to be adult offenders. So when we work to reverse and interrupt those cycles, we're doing it not just around juvenile crime, but it's an investment in the next generation of our city.
I want to ask you about Justin Ellis, who wrote an article for The Atlantic that I'm sure you've read, basically about this Band-Aid that's been ripped off or this scab that's been ripped off of Minneapolis. Most people think of the Twin Cities as this progressive haven. And the George Floyd thing kind of, and that thing is a murder, kind of laid bare the incredible disparities that we have in the Twin Cities. Now, this is nationwide, but most people don't think of Minneapolis and St. Paul as cities that have huge disparities in academic achievement, for example. I think Minnesota is actually 50th in the country in terms of high school graduation. And I talked to Chris Coleman, your predecessor, just about this and this history, and the history of redlining, the history of racism, systemic racism in the Twin Cities. It goes back quite a ways. What are your
racism goes back quite a ways? Is that the quote you just said?
Okay, that's an understatement. Thanks, Melvin.
It does go back quite a ways. Yes, I would agree.
I was saying in the Twin Cities.
No, I'm kidding.
Because historically, yes, there's been racism for at least 75, 80 years in our country.
Give or take, at least.
Yeah. But he kind of, you know, on home ownership, he kind of pointed to the GI Bill after World War II, soldiers coming back, and white soldiers getting houses, and black soldiers not, because they're redlined, and banks wouldn't loan to people who own houses in redlined areas. But what has been your thinking about just this sort of disparity of what Americans, a lot of people think about the Twin Cities and the reality?
In many ways, the Twin Cities is America, right? It's a microcosm of America in a real microscope. And people don't see us in this way, but we have this incredible international, multilingual, intercultural space where we have our historic African-American communities here. We have waves of Irish and German refugees who are here. We have much more recent Asian and African, East African refugee communities who are all here kind of in this same space together.
A very large Hmong community.
Very large Somali community. And a lot of this is, in many ways, the Twin Cities is a fundamentally different metro area than even the Twin Cities metro area that I grew up in. And our systems haven't transformed our systems to keep pace with our transforming population and demographics. And so, yes, I think one of the most disturbing pieces about George Floyd's murder is just how historically unsurprising it is that, you know, we are on the place on the road that we've been on our way to for quite some time. And that's not just Minneapolis and St. Paul. It's not just Minnesota. That's our country. We have this, you know, long history of racism that you just alluded to that we haven't fully reckoned with. We haven't acknowledged. 10 years ago, we thought we were living in a post-racial society. I say we with air quotations around it. You know, we had this conversation about living in a post-racial society, which, you know, now we realize just how asinine that notion is. But when we see Philando Castile and Eric Garner and Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor and all of these people on this long line of black men and women in particular, unarmed, unaggressive, killed by law enforcement, and no one held accountable. And I think one of the strongest social commentaries of this moment is that Officer Chauvin and those other three officers killed George Floyd in cold blood on television. And none of us are confident. I don't know anybody who would bet pink slips that they're going to face prison for it. Because from Philando Castile on, every single one of these videos, and I think Will Smith, I think it was, said recently, you know, at some point, you know, racism isn't new. It's just being filmed now. Mm-hmm. But over the last 10 years, we've seen video after video after video. And the rhetorical question, the hurtful, harmful, painful rhetorical question has been just like, how bad and brazen does it have to be in order for somebody to be held accountable? And, you know, time after time, each video we see goes, okay, that's got to be the one. Like now, like somebody's going to go to prison for that. And over and over and over again, we see either, you know, people not even be charged or being charged and having a dramatic trial and then being acquitted. And so at some point, unless there's accountability, then of course that is going to continue to play out. And then you have the I think insult to injury is when people see, instead of housing resources, instead of Section 8, instead of food, instead of child care supports, instead of the type of investments that would help to stabilize a community, those types of investments like my father was trying to build through Save Our Sons, instead of that, we just spend $200 billion on policing and prisons in our country so that we can sort of try to isolate the rest of us from that element, you know, so to speak. And I think that creates a level of resentment, and that's what's literally boiling over in our streets right now.
Yeah, that's obviously compounding historical mistakes, locking people up, and, you know, taking men from their families. So the kids grow up without their father. That's not a good idea.
And look, we literally spend more over the last 30 years in America. We've spent more on prisons and police every single year, right? And go look at Gallup. Their polling shows that Americans feel every single year they poll Americans, and something like 2/3 of Americans feel like crime is worse this year than it was last year. So we just keep doing literally the same. What's that quote about doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result being the definition of insanity?
That's the quote.
It's time for a new approach to public safety.
Well, yeah. And of course, that isn't true. Our crime, you know, we are safer.
Right.
Crime has gone down.
That's right.
You know, every year. And part of the reason they may think it hasn't because Donald Trump lies about it, saying it went up during the Obama years, which it didn't.
And Al, it's not just Donald Trump, but, you know, like
yep.
police unions, private prison operators, all of the folks who have deep levels of investment in our prison industrial, public safety industrial complex are spending a lot of money to tell us that we're in danger, we're a lot less safe, and that we should be worried about, you know, quote unquote, those people. And, you know, one of the things that we are working hard to break in St. Paul is the notion that we're going to spend, we're going to allocate millions of dollars based on that fear-based rhetoric that has no basis in data or fact. And so, you know, we're pushing very hard for a public safety framework that centers around evidence and data, things that are, you know, proven by independent research to be effective, and using that data to guide our decision making on a day-to-day and year-to-year basis. And I'll tell you, it's a challenge, but we're going to do it.
Well, then you've been looking at data, I'm sure. And what does that data tell you? Now, I mean, for example, some of the expenditures that we're seeing police forces use are things like, you know, the armored vehicles and grenade launchers. You did a letter of reform on the use of tasers, didn't you, when you're in the city council?
Yep, that would have been 2008. I think it was in preparation for the RNC in St. Paul.
And what was that? What, tell us about that.
Well, it was a request from our chief at the time to purchase tasers for every officer. And tasers can be a great tool if they're used in substitute for a gun. But the concern is, in as we've seen in video after video, a culture of escalation and violence in law enforcement, the concern is that we'll use it in situations where words could suffice and respect could suffice. And, you know, just interactions that are based on shared humanity could suffice. And my perspective at the time was, and I still believe, we didn't have at that time the level of policies and procedures and safeguards in place to govern when and how they should be used and when they are used, how that use of force is reported. Is a taser, this is kind of, you know, a global question, is a taser less than lethal force? Is it non-lethal force? Is it potentially lethal force? Where does it land on those kind of use of force continuums that are all in the news kind of these days? And so I just wasn't comfortable. Saw some, you know, police reports of people who had been sort of drive stunned by tasers because they were, you know, the officer wanted them to stand up, but they didn't, or they wanted them to sit down or come this way and they didn't, and were drive stunning people like cattle. And that's something that we have written out of our policies at this point, but had to work with the police department to come up with a fundamentally new approach. By the way, at the time, our training materials on how and when and where to use them was written by a company called Taser International, which struck me as a little circular.
Well, they know tasers, I'll say that. Let's talk about police reform writ large. People are very aware that the Minneapolis City Council has voted to defund the police department in Minneapolis. We don't know exactly what that means. You are obviously thinking a lot about this. What is your approach on police reform?
Our approach is a couple of things. One, we've seen just in the last couple of weeks the sort of paradox of policing, right? We've seen some of the worst policing humanly possible on video, between seeing George Floyd's horrific and like hauntingly casual murder while this officer has his hand in his pocket. We've seen a 75-year-old man just pushed for no reason in a way that he sustained brain damage because of it. We've seen, you know, a young man shot in the back by police, and just we've seen all of these videos and all these just horrific examples. At the same time, though, we've seen our officers step forward to try to protect some of the neighborhoods that have been targeted for, you know, the civil unrest. I don't call them demonstrations or protests, because those aren't protests. We've seen, you know, some really amazingly beautiful, peaceful protests across our country. But then we've also seen people who seemingly just came out to break a window and start a fire.
St. Paul, actually, in that, I mean, any destruction was terrible. But St. Paul got off better. I mean, obviously, this was the Minneapolis Police Department. But you had your police out there on the first night. Am I right?
Oh yeah, we had them out there the whole that whole week. I mean, it was a scary week. And that's what I was saying, is like we needed them and we relied on them. We relied on them to usher peaceful protests and peaceful marches in front of the Capitol, in front of the governor's residence, down the freeway, down some of our major streets in our city. So we relied on them, and that's the paradox. We need officers who understand and respect our humanity, and our lives are on the line, and praying that when we call for help, it's not Derek Chauvin responding to us.
Well, we're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back with St. Paul Mayor Melvin Carter.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Welcome back. I'm talking to Melvin Carter, the mayor of St. Paul. I just want to go to what you see as police reform in your city.
It's a great question. It starts with transparency. It starts with ensuring our communities that our officers are accountable, that we're transparent, that we are a part of community, and that we're not an occupying force that's here to sort of enforce the line between the haves and the have-nots. I think it starts, people talk a lot about training, but I think it starts upstream of that. Our chief always says, you hire the person and train the cop. We need, you know, instead of hiring people from all over the globe who may have a police officer certification, and then trying to teach them about diversity and trying to teach them about community and trying to teach them where our local neighborhood recreation centers are. You know, my father's a perfect example of somebody who grew up knowing every single person in community, knowing all the community institutions, the leaders, the gathering spaces, the kind of unwritten codes, and then was trained to be a really good police officer. And so I think it starts with who you hire. I firmly believe that, you know, if you got to train somebody not to kneel on somebody's neck for 8 minutes and 46 seconds, then that person should be disqualified from ever having a badge in the first place. And so, you know, training is important, but it starts with hiring. It starts with how we train. It starts with how we hold each other accountable. And it means being able to fire folks. Our chief and chiefs across the country would tell you that they see officers who, you know, commit egregious acts that fall below our standards, that betray the public trust, and they fire them just to see them reinstated through arbitration processes by police unions that somehow have created this culture of just protecting police officers at all costs. And this is where you see the Minneapolis Police Union president lamenting publicly that the national press won't refer to George Floyd as a violent criminal. You know, those are people who are the stewards or the keepers of this culture that we absolutely fundamentally have to break. And so there's that accountability. There's like having those officers, those civilian officers who are part of community and walk among us. But then there's also beyond that, there's the point that people call 911 for a whole bunch of reasons, and they don't all mandate somebody showing up with a badge and a gun. People call 911 because somebody's in crisis, or there's somebody with mental health challenges, or in a addiction or overdose type of scenario. And so, you know, I think another piece of it is to say, how do we invest instead of just investing all the money after the fact, after a crime occurs, and saying we're going to race as fast as we can to the spot after something bad happens? Well, that's not good enough for my kids. That's not good enough for our family. Like we ought to be investing to reduce the likelihood that something bad is going to happen in the first place. And so I think it also includes, as we think about law enforcement reform, is going to have to include some balanced and measured investments so that we are making the proactive type of measures that can help us stabilize neighborhoods. And I'll tell you, I think that's going to be critical towards debunking the resentment that people across our country have for the police officers in the first place, when we can always afford to hire, you know, a million more police officers in our country, but we can never afford to clear the Section 8 waiting list.
What you're talking about is a huge task, but it's a huge task we have to undertake.
We have communities, and too often it's color-coded, literally, but we have communities across our country where we're investing, you know, more in our schools and in our young people than we are in law enforcement after something bad happens. It just so happens that those communities very rarely overlap with the places in our communities where you have the largest populations of people of color.
When you were talking about who shows up from a 911 call, that was what I took defunding to mean. That instead of a cop with a gun, you have a mental health professional show up when there's a mental health problem. You have a drug, a person knows how to deal with someone who is addicted to drugs or help them. And that to me is what I interpret as defunding. Also, well, maybe some of the equipment that we were talking about, like grenade launchers, et cetera.
Yeah, and I think the equipment is important. I think the equipment is sort of a relic of a culture, right? If you think about cultures, they have, you know, behaviors and they have relics. I'm not remembering all the things from my anthropology classes, but those relics become, like those symbols of culture become important because, you know, when you have a police department that's getting from the Department of Defense, you know, the tanks and the rocket launchers and all that type of stuff that's intended to engage a hostile enemy, well, then that'll, of course, help seed a culture that when we go out into the neighborhoods of our streets, when we're patrolling in front of our grocery stores, we're engaging a hostile enemy. And so, yes, those those relics have to change. We have to start getting rid of those. But the bigger piece is the mentality that, fundamentally speaking, just has to change. And to your point about having those other folks who respond, Al, if there's one thing teachers and police officers have in common, we always hear them say, we can't be the social workers. We can't be the mental health counselors. We don't have the capacity or experience to be the drug counselors and all of these other things that the children and the families that we serve need. Well, that's an acknowledgement right there from our police officers that our communities would be better off if we had resources to help fund those types of supports. And so it's insane to me that every time we try to say, well, let's put some money into social workers. That's one of the things we're doing in St. Paul. We've embedded social workers into police cars to co-respond, to show up with an officer when we get some of those kind of calls for people in crisis, to help connect them to resources and support and not just further crisis. But when we propose things like that, you know, there's always somebody who's ready to say, oh, you're anti-cop. Well, no, this is providing a resource that our police officers have very, very clearly said over and over and over again that would help.
I think it's fair to say you're not anti-cop. Your dad was a great cop and a community, but he did drive a tank, I know, through the neighborhood.
Right. It was a big white conversion van that looked like something out of Scooby-Doo. That's actually true. He did ride one of those.
Oh, he did. Okay. But it wasn't a tank.
It wasn't a tank.
Now, where did you grow up? This is a real odd segue, but did you grow up in Rondo?
I did. I grew up in the Rondo neighborhood in St. Paul. You know the history.
Yep.
It's the neighborhood, and this story has played out literally all across the country from Detroit to Oakland and everywhere in between. It's the neighborhood in St. Paul that was a thriving, historic African-American community, doctors and lawyers. And my grandfather owned over a half a dozen commercial properties out there. And that's the neighborhood that was completely uprooted to build the freeway, I-94, here in St. Paul.
Yeah, without, of course, consulting anyone in Rondo.
We're compensating them.
That's true.
And my father remembers, as a child, not just being kicked out of his mother's home, but seeing his mom's home burned down by our fire department as a training exercise. And so when you see instances like that, Al, where the fire department, the very people who we pay our taxes to protect me from fire, just burned down my mother's home, the very people who George Floyd pays taxes to protect him in emergency, put their knee on his neck for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. So that's what adds the insult to the injury for it. These are the folks who we are paying to do the very opposite of the service that we're getting from them.
And what I understand was when you say people weren't compensated, they weren't fairly compensated at all. Right. House was taken, you got pennies on the dollar, right?
Quite literally, yes. Yes.
As if there isn't enough wealth, your number one source of capital or your money is your home. And right. For them to take that away and not compensate you is a crime. But there were a lot of crimes.
There
is what
are.
You're saying.
And that goes back to what you were talking about redlining. As we think about how wealth is organized in our country, one, there's just no way to, with a straight face, pretend that the great wealth that is America is not directly created, directly rooted in the institution of American slavery, which, as we celebrate Juneteenth and have this conversation about Juneteenth, is very relevant right now. And, you know, every time somebody says that, somebody says, well, that's 400 years ago. I share with folks, Al, if I was a billionaire because my great-great-grandfather stole $1 million from your great-great-grandfather, you might have some feelings about that, even if I say, oh, that's in the past. Get over it. But even beyond that, from the Homestead era to redlining to, you know, Tuskegee experiment, the interstates, the way the interstates came through, to the very well-documented continued disparities that exist and systemic discrimination that exists in everything from home lending to college application processes. It's not that something happened, you know, 150 years ago that somebody's still complaining about. It's that those same economic forces have continued to play out, have continued to exacerbate themselves. And in the midst of all of it, you know, one of the most tragic, heinous parts of the way we've now organized our criminal justice system is, on top of all of that, once somebody's been arrested, and we know in particular African-American men are severely over-criminalized in America, then they can't vote and be a part of the solution to help turn it around anyways.
And if you're a young man who gets arrested for pot possession, then you're not eligible for certain federal scholarships, right?
That's right.
And those arrests were very, very skewed. Blacks and whites smoked marijuana at the same percentage, but the arrests of blacks for possession of marijuana, much, much higher, 5-1 or something.
That's it, exactly. Because if in my neighborhood, we spend more on police than we do on our schools and mental health supports and, chemical health, and in your neighborhood, we spend more on mental health supports and schools and chemical health. Well, then I'll be hypercriminalized. I'll have what's called the enforcement bias that, all of us, if a police officer follows us long enough, they can come up with something to pull us over for. And so, we'll get overcriminalized while somebody else will get resources. And that's what's making people so angry.
Do you think this moment that we will build on this moment, do you think that there has been a change? There was a lead up to George Floyd in terms of there was one after another, but that video is so hideous in so many ways. And what we saw national and worldwide. But the data on polling in terms of do we have systemic racism in this country, that was a huge jump. And I think people woke up. I'm hoping people woke up. And I've seen moments like this go away. But what do you see? Do you see this as a real moment to build on?
I'd say two things. One is the shortest answer is yes, and I've felt that before, right? After Philando Castile was killed, we had his funeral at the cathedral in St. Paul. That felt like just a fundamental turning point. That just felt like we can't go back from here, and yet here we are once again. And so I think one of the things that is clear to me is, we've been to these funerals before. We've, tweeted these hashtags before. We've demanded justice before. And so the truth is, none of what's happened already really makes this moment fundamentally different than those other moments that we've had. What's going to make it different is what happens next. I am encouraged by just what seems to be an awakening, if you believe that kind of national polling that you just described. I'm also encouraged. Like, it's really incredible. Like, we had really just one night of the just horrific, riotous, arsonist type of behavior that, other cities have had a lot more of. And the next morning, just literally, like, out of nowhere, just neighbors showed up with shovels and brooms and trash cans and paintbrushes and, sponges to just help each other clean up. And they weren't just helping like their friend with their friend's business or something like that. They're just coming out to help strangers. We've had business leaders who have had their business literally still boarded up, and before they fixed their own windows, before they fixed their own business, they've transformed their parking lot into a supply drive to help families, kind of just come and give and take the supplies that people need. We had a business owner in our Midway area that was like at the epicenter of all of it. That she We were standing outside of her building and it was completely burned down. She's gonna have to do a complete rebuild. And she told me, I've lost everything. And I said, I know, but we're gonna be with you as you rebuild. And she said, no, I was just trying to say I have time to help with the fundraising efforts for other businesses as well. And that type of spirit of in the way that people are just taking care of each other, people who wouldn't really have a way of even knowing each other otherwise, that to me feels like something new. The energy that exists across our country, I'm very convinced that this energy that we've seen, this fiery spirit across our country, I should say, I think is the same energy that built America. It's the same energy that abolished slavery. It's the same energy that ushered in civil rights. And I think channeled healthily, channeled productively, that's the same energy that's going to make this a fundamentally different moment. And God willing, relieve our children from having to live through these cycles over and over and over again in the way that we've had to.
I see that, and I have a lot of hope for that. And of course, we have a presidential election coming up. We have elections for the Senate and the House. I have a good feeling about the direction that's going, and I have a good feeling that there will be concrete steps here. I also saw that at least the Republicans on police reform actually gave lip service. That was an improvement. They basically are putting legislation together in the Senate that kind of has a lot of the same ideas. They just aren't actually funded or mandatory.
Yeah, that I tell you, that was really disappointing. Senator Scott started that press conference by saying, "We see you and we hear you," and then there was very little in the rest of that announcement to make. I would imagine the folks who have just been called out into the streets to fight against injustice feel seen or heard. You know what, Al? This feels like the Hunger Games. Like Americans are losing their lives in ways that are unjust, in ways that are just brutal and horrific, and are on television, for God's sake. And what we're hearing from the Capitol is, we're going to study it and we're going to create a commission and we're going to create some incentives for jurisdictions across the country to voluntarily sign up to stop doing this. And that's just not enough. I mean, they couldn't even find the fortitude to ban chokeholds. Like at some level, we just saw George Floyd choked to death for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. Like, it'd be nice to just hear from Washington, D.C., you know what? You can't do that. Just period. We're not going to tie it to incentives or grants. We're just going to say, you can't do that. And they couldn't bring themselves to do that. That's hurtful. I don't imagine that's going to be satisfactory for the people who are demanding just a fundamental restructuring of the way the relationship between law enforcement and community works.
Melvin, I know your time is incredibly valuable, but I just am so gratified to see how great you're doing, and I just love your folks. And I don't want to say I'm proud of you. That's kind of stupid. But I'm proud of you because we have a mayor in St. Paul. That's great. You're killing it, man.
I'm doing what I can, and I appreciate you saying so. You know, this is such a big moment that oftentimes it just feels like no matter what we do, it's not enough. But I appreciate you saying so.
That beautiful music is from Leo Kottke. I want to make sure to remind you to subscribe to the Al Franken Podcast. You can do that by subscribing to the Al Franken Podcast. And review us on whatever the hell you're on. And I want to thank my executive producer, Peter Ogburn, for all he does to make this a great, great podcast. We'll talk again next week. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken Podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
The early 2000s was a wild time for reality TV. There seemed to be an endless supply of shows that delivered entertainment for us, but trauma for children. I'm Misha Brown, the host of Wondery's podcast, The Big Flop. Each week on The Big Flop, comedians join me to chronicle the biggest pop culture fails of all time and try to answer the age-old question, who thought this was a good idea? We recently looked behind the scenes of what was really going on at Abby Lee Miller's dance studio. Abby's biggest misstep wasn't screaming nonsensical catchphrases or throwing chairs on television, but instead, she was choreographing financial fraud in plain sight. Join me to break down all the wild details of Abby Lee Miller's story. Follow The Big Flop on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Big Flop early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
Once upon a beat. Remember those stories and fables that would capture your imagination and you couldn't wait to see how they would unfold? And now, when you read them as an adult, you think some of these old tales could use a fresh spin. We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remix, and reimagine for the kids in your life today. Join me, DJ Fuse, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, as we spin up new tales in the New Kids and Family Podcast, Once Upon a Beat. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a jam-packed, music-filled weekly party where hip-hop and fables meet. It's Once Upon a Beat. Follow Once Upon a Beat on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Once Upon a Beat.